or take out. For good food, good service, and good friends, it's the Quarterback Club in Northfield.
National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, and you joined us for today's edition of National Security This Week. We get together every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security, and we're fortunate enough to be joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us learn more about American national security. We're starting a new series of shows today. We'll be covering different agencies in the U.S. intelligence community throughout the fall, learning how they are organized, what missions they carry out in support of American national security, and how they're aligned inside the U.S. intelligence community. Today, we're going to begin in that series with the Defense Intelligence Agency, or DIA, as it is called. And with us to discuss DIA is the current director, U.S. Army Lieutenant General Scott Barrier. Lieutenant General Scott Barrier serves as the 22nd director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Prior to joining DIA, Barrier served in the Department of the Army as the 46th G2. In that role, he was the principal military intelligence and counterintelligence officer and advisor to the secretary and the chief of staff of the U.S. Army, and the Army's intelligence community representative in the U.S. intelligence community. Lieutenant General Barrier is a career intelligence officer, having served and commanded at every level from company to commanding general and senior mission commander. His Army, Joint, and Special Operations assignments include service throughout the United States, the Republic of Korea, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Scott Barrier earned a bachelor's degree in history from the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point, a master's degree in general studies from Central Michigan University, and a master's degree in strategic studies from the U.S. Army War College. Lieutenant General Scott Barrier, welcome to National Security This Week.
John, it's great to be here with you, and thanks for having me.
And where are you sitting this morning, sir? You and I are on Zoom, so we have an opportunity to see each other. But where are you sitting?
Right. I'm in a, an offline conference room within the DIA headquarters we use for unclassified activities like this.
Yeah, because most things that happen at the intelligence agencies are in the classified world, so jumping on a thing like Zoom in a skiffed space is probably not an ideal thing to do, right?
We found that, no, you're absolutely right. We found that during COVID we needed to acquire a space like this so we could communicate with the workforce and do other things. So it's actually come in quite handy. It's probably a keeper for us.
All right. General, you're the current director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Can you please explain to our listeners what DIA is, how it fits into the Department of Defense? I'm sure most listeners have no idea how large DIA is as an agency, how many people work at the agency, let alone what the people at DIA do every day.
Sure, happy to do that. So I'll start by saying we're a global organization, and at our core, I think we're an intelligence operations and all source analysis agency, meaning that we conduct intelligence operations and do all source analysis. About 16,500 people. Those are collectors, analysts, mission enablers, IT folks, data scientists, and we're really postured around the globe. And I think what makes us different than the other 17. Intelligence agencies is this global network that we have. So if you think about it, our defense attaché service puts military diplomats in 140 embassy locations with accreditation into 183. Those are 183 potential partnerships that we can take advantage of. And we have a great history with our defense attaché corps. We're also embedded in the 11 combatant command joint intelligence operations centers. So all of those intel staffs in the combatant commands are comprised of DIA officers that are around the globe on 24/7 watch, working with combatant commanders for their needs.
And General, if I may ask, so that, just to confirm, just the combatant commanders are like U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, Central Command, European Command, things like that, right?
Correct, and also U.S. Strategic Command, U.S. Special Operations Command. Yeah, thank you. And I think the really interesting thing here is our history. So we were formed, we were conceived in 1960, but actually started operations in 1961. We gave the Secretary of Defense sort of a different intelligence view from what his Army, Air Force, and Navy, and Marine Corps were giving him. And our first baptism by fire was the Cuban Missile Crisis there. And if you're in our museum on the first floor of the DIA headquarters, you'll see all of that. But we truly are an all-source agency. And I always tell people that this is not your mom's DIA or this is not your dad's DIA. I think the thing that's changed here and what the National Defense Strategy has given us is this notion of intelligence support to strategic competition. And so we're on that march right now, and we've done some things differently here at DIA that I'm happy to talk about that make us so different right now.
So DIA headquarters is at Bolling Air Force Base in Washington, D.C. What other DIA, you know, intelligence facilities fall under DIA's purview, and not just the combatant commands at the Joint Intel Operations Centers?
Right. So we say generally that about half of our workforce is in the National Capital Region. That extends from Maryland to probably Charlottesville, and then at various locations and facilities. And then we have our Missile Space Intelligence Center down in Huntsville, Alabama. But then we have other operating bases in CONUS, in Europe, in the Pacific, that give us unique insights and access to sources, which makes it really unique and interesting. You know, the workforce here at DIA, 70% civilian. Of those civilians, 40% have military experience. And then we have 30%, which are military officers and NCOs and soldiers, airmen, sailors, Marines, Coast Guardsmen, and Guardians that are assigned to DIA around the globe. So it's a really nice mix of civilian and military, which really makes our mission fun and unique for the Department of Defense.
Yeah, you just mentioned Guardians. So the Space Force recently stood up. Has it been a lot to deal with as you sort of integrate the Guardians into the DIA structure and support what Space Force does?
So I think we've had a longstanding operation for space and support of space, really for Space Force, Spacecom. And we've had a longstanding operation to monitor objects in space. And so that's one of the things that a lot of people don't know about us. So we've had a very close relationship on that front. But I think that the stand up of Space Force and really the development of their intelligence, their service intelligence center, is really the newest injection, if you will, into the intelligence mission set here. And so we've assisted Space Force in doing that, and we continue to monitor their progress and help them along the way.
As I understand it, is that the National Space Intelligence Center? Is that at Wright Pat?
It will be the National Space Intelligence Center and closely aligned with the National Air and Space Intelligence Center, which is the Service Intel Center. We have a very close relationship with all those Service Intel Centers. In fact, we are very close with them on what they produce, when they produce, how they produce it. And so this Defense Intelligence Enterprise gives us that access to those intelligence centers, and we work very, very closely with all of them.
All right. So for our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Lieutenant General Scott Barrier, who's the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and we're discussing DIA's role in the U.S. intelligence community. General, how does DIA fit within the broader U.S. intelligence community? Perhaps you could highlight the specialty areas for the other USIC partners and explain what niche areas DIA fills in the overall USIC.
Yeah, great question. So when I think about all of the intelligence agencies, how we're structured, how we're organized, the kinds of training that we have, the kind of skill sets that we bring, it sounds odd, but we're probably most like the CIA. The difference is we're the Defense Intelligence Agency, and my boss is the Secretary of Defense and really the chairman. Of course, the big boss is the president. We all get that. We also have a very special relationship with Avril Haines, our DNI. But my direct boss in the Pentagon is the Honorable Ron Moultrie. He's the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, and he provides the oversight for all of the defense intelligence agencies, what we call the combat support agencies. So if you think about them, it's DIA, NSA, NGA, and NRO. It's really interesting because we have all grown up in the intelligence community together. And so the really neat thing is we all know each other, and guess what? We all like each other. And so when I think about asymmetric advantages, the fact that we're all good friends and that we routinely talk is really, really powerful for our nation, for the intelligence community as a whole. Our DNI has been superb, along with Honorable Moultrie, in pulling us all together frequently to have discussions, which is really great. But if you think about NRO, they're really responsible for building the space architecture and building our satellites and getting them on orbit to do what they need to do. The National Geospatial Agency, led by Vice Admiral Trey Whitworth, really responsible for all of the geospatial intelligence that we bring to bear here in the agency. The National Security Agency, General Paul Nakasone, bringing all things cyber and cryptology to the nation to have a better understanding about intentions and what's happening. All of that is used by DIA in our all-source analysis, which is foundational to everything we do. And if you think about the mission set, for DI. That, John, that hasn't changed since our inception in 1961. We are responsible for foundational military intelligence around the globe. We have to be the master sense makers of what foreign militaries are doing, what their capabilities are, what their intentions are, and what their doctrine is, so that we can bring that to the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman for decision advantage in a timely way that helps them with this strategic competition problem that we have.
And how does DIA sort of connect with the other members of the U.S. intelligence community that are not inside the Department of Defense?
Sure. So a very, very close relationship with INR at State. Our partners at the FBI are very, very close. In fact, in many of the offices and locations where these different agencies have operations ongoing, many times you'll find officers from DIA there or officers from the National Geospatial Agency. So the connections are deep. They're across the globe, and the communication between all of the chiefs, deputies, operations officers is really, really tight. And I think we have to be. And that really starts at the top with Avril Haines' leadership, flows down through the department, through Honorable Moultrie, to all of us. And so, you know, our expectation is that with transparency and with connectivity that we're talking all the time, and we do that.
And General Barry, I'd like to drill down a little bit more into the work at DIA specifically. The major intelligence agencies often have a specialty area of excellence. You mentioned it just a minute ago. NSA focuses very, very heavily on signals intelligence with a cyber component. Are there any specialty areas at DIA you'd like to highlight for our listeners?
Yeah, there are a number of areas that I'd like to highlight. And probably when people think of DIA, they sort of think about the human intelligence collection mission that we have. We do that in three ways: with our defense attaché service, with those military diplomats. We do it with our defense clandestine service, which brings us special titles and authorities to do intelligence collection. We do that with our defense debriefing service. We want to talk to people. We want to establish relationships. You know, human intelligence is the oldest form of intelligence collection, and it will last beyond what technology can give us, because relationships and talking to people and understanding what people think and what they know is really, really key. So whether you're recruiting sources or just having a conversation, these things are really, really important to DI, and we've done it very, very well for many, many years, and we hold that mission set dear to us. But we also do all source analysis, and if you think about what we bring to the Department of Defense, it's the kludging of all of that other information out there from those agencies that I talked about to give a full all source picture to the department, to the secretary, and to the chairman, which is really, really key. And over time, and as the agency has grown and developed, we've done some really, really interesting things and other things that have, hold on one second. We've got an alarm going off here. I'm just going to mute for one second.
Yep. Sounds like we might have a little bit of a fire drill or something happening there at DIA headquarters. For our listeners, briefly, this is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Lieutenant General Scott Barrier, the Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and we're discussing DIA's role in the U.S. intelligence community. And unfortunately, the general is not in control of when alarms go off at the building, and as soon as that alarm finishes going off, he'll come off of mute, and we'll be able to continue our discussions today. The background for our audience, the Defense Intelligence Agency, or DIA, is one of the intelligence agencies that's inside the Department of Defense. And the other major intelligence agencies that are also inside the Department of Defense include the National Security Agency, or NSA, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, or NGA, and then, as General Scott Barrier mentioned a little while ago, NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, is another major component part of that, focusing significantly on space operations, creating the satellites that we need to do technical collection from space. How are we doing, General Barrier? Is that alarm still going on?
So there's a little announcement going on in the background, but I think we're okay. If it's all right with you, John, I'd like to continue talking about some of the more unique things we do in our Directorate for Analysis.
Please do, sir. Yes.
So as I look at my organizational chart here within the Director of Analysis, we do some really important things for the department. I think the first thing I'd like to highlight is the Defense Counterproliferation Office. This organization really tries to understand what nuclear capacities and capabilities are in nations around the globe and keep an eye on that. Much like our Defense Combating Terrorism Center, DCTC, which has been involved in every aspect of counterterrorism operations since 9/11. An office that has kept watch on, you name the group, and they are on it, and they're still doing that. We do the machine-assisted analytic rapid repository system, which is a replacement for something known as the Military Intelligence Integrated Database. What we know about installations and militaries around the globe, really, really facilitated by that. And then one of the really interesting things, especially in COVID, is the National Center for Medical Intelligence, which is responsible in the Department of Defense for understanding pandemics and giving warning to the department on certain medical things happening. And then the last one I'll highlight in the Director for Analysis is really the Underground Facility Analysis Center, what we call UFAC, understanding all those developing underground command and control centers, weapon storage facilities around the globe, you name the country. We try to do our best to understand that. And then as we move across this organization at DIA, I want to talk a little bit about our integrated intelligence centers. So we have the America's Trans-Regional Threat Center, which covers down in this hemisphere, whether that be for strategic competition in Russia and China, or whether it's counter-drug or supporting homeland security on what they're trying to do with migration and immigration. We have the East Eurasia Regional Center, covers all things Europe, and you can imagine how active they have been of a crisis group related to the Ukraine. Very, very busy place. We have the Indo-Pacific Regional Center right now, which watches everything in the Pacific region. And then we have the Middle East and Africa Regional Center. So keeping an eye on CENTCOM and AFRICOM from here at DI. And the last integrated center that we have just stood up, and I'm happy to announce publicly, is the China Mission Group, or the CMG. That will take all of the agency's capacities and capabilities, put it in one location for support to the department's strategic competition issues with China. So we're very, very excited for that. And remember, I said earlier, this is not your mom or dad's DIA. I think the thing that's really, really new besides the China Mission Group is another office called the Deputy Director for Global Integration, or DDGI. This is the office and officer who's responsible in the way a J3 would, if you're familiar with the military, sort of an operations officer view, the way that we collaborate, coordinate, and integrate all of our capabilities that the agency has towards strategic competition. So we're excited about that. That office is about a little over a year old right now, and really instrumental to stand up for strategic competition, and also instrumental in the stand up of the China Mission Group. All of those regional intelligence centers work for our DDGI.
So if I could just drill down a little bit more even. So DIA has a strategic intelligence level mission to support policymakers primarily in the D.C. area. But you also have a mission in supporting the combatant commanders for theater operations and even down to the tactical level when troops are engaged in combat. Is that right? Do I have that right, General?
We absolutely do. I think people have this notion that DI is purely for strategic intelligence to support the department's policy and planning. And that's true. We do. But if you think about our embeds into the combatant command, so think of what's happening in U.S. European Command right now. We very, very rapidly moved to support the EUCOM J2, who's an active duty Army Major General, and his needs to be able to help his commander understanding what was happening in the Russia-Ukraine crisis, and the ability to surge intelligence support to that theater for a variety of missions has been ongoing. And so we do find ourselves frequently talking tactical level intelligence detail, not only with the European commanders there, combatant commanders and service commanders, but also with the chairman and secretary on a daily basis. So from troops in contact to policies affecting sharing and everything else, we're kind of in the middle of all of that.
So it sounds to me also like there's an increasing intelligence partner collaboration that occurs between the United States Armed Forces, our allies, and other partner countries around the world. And that I think has become a high priority for DIA, unless I have that wrong. Can you discuss why this collaboration, this partnership with other nations is so important, and how DIA is enriching those partnerships?
John, it's really, really important, and we are all about partnerships, and the NDS really directs us and says that we can't do this alone, and so we've got to have great partners. Several years ago, we stood up the Deputy Director for Commonwealth Integration, or DDCI. That is a general officer from one of our Five Eye partner nations, would be it Australia, UK, Canada, or New Zealand, who really helps me integrate the power of everything that we're doing and the power of what the partners are bringing to be able to orchestrate that, not only in the Five Eyes, but also other partnerships. And so within our DDGI construct, we've created a Partner Mission Integration Center. And so for the first time at DIA, John, what we're trying to do is to put an umbrella around all partnerships, whether they be foreign partnerships with foreign partners, whether they be academic partnerships with universities across the country, think tank partnerships with the great think tanks that we have across the country, and our defense industrial base and sensitive relationship partners out there. And so if you think about it, you have a partnership common operating picture that allows us to evaluate the effectiveness of those partnerships, but really where we need to invest more or perhaps decrease because we're not getting the most out of it. So for the first time, we have this partnership common operating picture, which allows me to press the throttle when I need to, pull back when I need to. But generally speaking, in the wake of what has happened in Russia, Ukraine, and as applies to Chinese encroachment in the Indo-Pacific, we feel like we're getting more partners all the time who want to talk about these things.
Okay, could you give, so I know when I was assigned at U.S. Special Operations Command many years ago, Central Command was also co-located there at MacDill Air Force Base. And even back then, we had a lot of partner nations who had established offices right there at the CENTCOM headquarters. So is that kind of thing happening now routinely across all the combatant commands? And DIA is probably building relationships with a lot of those partner nations, those coalition partners that are at the various combatant commands. Is that kind of how that's working?
Well, certainly, you know, the coalition village at CENTCOM was a bit of a one-off after 9/11 because of that terrible event and the crisis that emerged after that. Our partners wanted to be involved in that. So if you think about the back end of the CENTCOM headquarters where we had coalition village, that was unique and different. And while that is still at CENTCOM to a degree, I think technology has brought us to another level. And so it's really, how do we connect with our partners virtually and constantly so that we can share the most important information with them that they need to know? And so really for DIA, it's about this connectivity that you and I have right now, but in a secure way. But it's also about understanding what capabilities they bring and what capabilities DIA can bring. So if you think about my authorities and capability, maybe it makes a trail. But if I grab a partner, they have authorities and capability. That's another trail. Then you have kind of a highway of capabilities. And we have to think differently about how we operationalize these partnerships and what we can actually do with them. Because I think we've sort of underinvested in that. And to date, you know, we've talked a lot about sharing information and doing analysis together. And that's great. But what kinds of intelligence operations could we do together? That's really the question. And that's really what we're trying to answer.
And then if you take a look at the U.S. European Command, that sort of overlaps nicely with NATO, the NATO structure that exists out there. And the commander of U.S. European Command is also dual-hatted as the military commander for the NATO forces. Obviously, you're supporting the commander of U.S. European Command, the J2 over there, you just mentioned a little while ago. But there's got to also be a pretty strong connection between DIA and our NATO partners over in the theater in Europe. I mean, how does that work? Could you sort of explain that to the audience?
So we do have an office that interacts with NATO on their turf on a routine basis every single day. So I feel like we have very, very close partnerships within NATO. We often have regional conferences with certain NATO partners, depending on where it's at. And, you know, when you think about Sweden and Finland potentially becoming the newest NATO partners, those are two partnerships that we're going to upgun a little bit to make sure that we understand their capabilities and what it is they want from DIA. So NATO is an awesome alliance, and it's only gotten stronger since the Russia-Ukraine crisis. And so I don't think Putin ever thought that would come, but it has solidified and galvanized NATO, which is pretty cool. And we want to be in the middle of that. And we're in the middle of it with General Cavoli, who's the U.S. EUCOM commander, and the commander in shape. And so he gets it. He is a huge intelligence fan. And so he's very close with DIA. He's very close with his J2 team. And we think that we're right in sync with him right now.
For our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Lieutenant General Scott Barrier, the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. So General Barrier, how have new technologies impacted the work at DIA? In other words, what role does something like artificial intelligence, which is really machine learning, we're not really at in true artificial intelligence yet, but really advanced machine learning, what role is that playing in supporting the analytical work at DIA, or even the processing of all of the information that comes in and on a technical means? How many of your analysts are looking at cyber-related topics every day? And could you talk a little bit about the real-time collaboration between agencies and allies enhanced dramatically because of the advances in technologies?
Yeah, I think this we could dedicate a whole day and have a conference on this topic with big data, how we handle that, how we take advantage of it, and really how we infuse that into our analysis. You know, in the old days, stubby pencils, card catalogs, and keeping records manually. And to a degree, with our most current database, this thing I mentioned earlier called MIDB, the Military Intelligence Integrated Database. So think of an Excel spreadsheet with a description and maybe a 4 or 5 year old image to give us an insight into what's happening at a particular location around the world. That is not good enough. We're not going to be able to survive in a high end, fast paced potential combat environment with that sort of database. So where we really invested in this is this thing called MARS, the Machine Assisted Rapid Repository System, which takes all of that MIDB analog stuff and infuses it into a new live database, interactive maps, data that is in real time ingested into a system so that we know what's happening on the ground at any given time. That data is out there. So the question for us is, how do we safely acquire it? How do we tag it and label it? And how do we put it into these files so that they're easily accessible by anybody who needs it in real time? Whether that's for situational awareness or that's for a future targeting operation, it has to be that good and that on time. And so the technologies that we are seeking are really surrounded by the ability to acquire big data from any location. So think about big data from space. Think about big data from commercial vendors. Think about big data wherever it comes from. And how do we assimilate that into our databases so that we have the most up-to-date, real-time, live environment for our analysts to be able to collaborate in. And we've had some success with this. As you might imagine, the Russia-Ukraine crisis has given us some reps and sets on how to track forces and how to do things. It's been really, really interesting. And it has advanced our understanding of the capabilities to a point where we'll be able to field much faster the new capability coming.
Do you see big value in sort of the commercial contractors and what they're providing these days in the way of data or commercial imagery, that kind of thing? Has that become a big part of what DIA does?
Absolutely. I think Trey Whitworth at NGA has the lead with Chris Scalise at NRO on how we corral the plethora of commercial satellite imagery, if you will, to be able to infuse in our products. So we do use that, but we rely on them to be able to manage that for us. But it is really interesting when I think about the rules that have to be put in place and the ability for us to make sure that we're not getting ripped off, right? So a couple of years ago, we established this thing called the Open Source Intelligence Center, the OSIC and DIA. The CIA has a very similar capability that's been around longer, but with my Defense Intelligence Enterprise Management Authorities for Open Source Intelligence, what we're doing is kind of setting the rules of the road in terms of policy, tradecraft, making sure that we can catalog all this commercial data so that if NGA buys the same thing as DIA, that we're both paying the same best price that we can, or if the Army is buying a data set, we want to make sure that the Army is getting the best price that they can. And so putting this bound, if you will, these boundaries around this commercial data so that we, the Department of Defense, can do the very best for the money that it has is really, really important. And more to come on that because it's going to be huge in the future.
You know, I retired from the Navy 11 and a half years ago. And what you were just describing to me at DIA, because that was my last assignment, was as naval attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Helsinki, Finland. I think if I walked into a DIA space today, an analytical space, I don't think I would recognize anything anymore. Sounds like all of the technology is completely revolutionary compared to what I had even 12 years ago.
Certainly the analysts are going to be really, really savvy. And, you know, dinosaurs like me, I understand the concept, but maybe don't have the speed that they do to be able to access the data. But this is really interesting. And a great hero of mine, Lieutenant General Sam Wilson, who was the director of DI in 1976, said that 70% of what the agency was doing in 1976, 70% was from open source. So if you think about it now, that's just greatly expanded and increased, probably 90%. But the key is how do we infuse that with the really sensitive data and how do we make sense of all of that for the department? Anecdotally, Sam Wilson was a plank holder in the Merrill's Marauder as a private.
And
he rose to the rank of a 3-star general as a director of DIA. So a really talented individual and somebody who we think pretty highly of around here.
So, General, obviously, intelligence analysis, I don't know if you know who Mark Lowenthal is, but he used to say that the intelligence analysis piece, that's the mainstay of why we have intelligence. DIA being an all-source intelligence analysis agency, you obviously have a whole bunch of intelligence analysts. Could you talk a little bit about the career paths for intelligence analysts at the Defense Intelligence Agency?
Yeah, so it's a career field that we rely on here. And there are a lot of things to do in DIA, but analysis is kind of the bread and butter. And so, you know, we don't just recruit one flavor, of talent. We're looking for a wide swath. Certainly we want STEM kids coming out of college that have maybe a data science background, certainly has a need for that. But I'm a history major. We have history majors here. We recruit poli-sci majors. We recruit regional experts. And, you know, the coin of the realm is somebody who is intellectually curious, somebody who will be rigorous with their trade craft and make sure that they double, triple check their work before we go to publishing. And so, you know, for our analysts at DI, I'm really proud of the work that they're doing. And through crisis after crisis, what they demonstrate to me is just a commitment to excellence and the fact that they want to be here and they're staying late. They're coming in early. They're on the target, they're on the mission, and they're making our nation proud with everything that they're doing.
And as I understand it, in the intelligence community today, we like to get a lot of cross-training, so intelligence analysts that might start out at DIA might not stay at the headquarters throughout their career. They might get a chance to bounce around to the theater, join Intel Operations Centers, or even move across the intelligence agency to some of the other partner agencies for a tour or two. Is that right?
Yeah, it's really unique here at DI. Now, we do, the entire IC has a joint duty assignment program, which is pretty cool, and allows you to go from one agency to the next for a 2 to 3 year assignment and then come back, bring all that experience back with you and enrich your own agency with that. So that's a great program. But even within at DIA, there is the ability to be mobile when you want to be mobile, what we call the global officer, somebody that will come to headquarters, work in the director of analysis or director of operations, and then perhaps move out to a combatant command or another platform that we have, and then come back to the agency, and then move again for kind of a rounding out assignment, broadening assignment. And there's this, I think, an internal dialogue within the agency about subject matter expert and a global officer that gets around. And I think you can have both. So let's say that you're an expert on Chinese missile technology and employment doctrine. You could be a SME here at DIA, but you could still go out to the Indo-PACOM J2 team and work that target or a similar target there and come back. And so there are ways to be global, to broaden and still stay within your subject matter expert comfort zone.
And the pinnacle for somebody who's on an Intel analyst career track, if they move up at DIA or the defense intelligence construct as a whole, or more broadly across the national intelligence community, they get some special title, sort of take over leadership responsibility for across either defense intelligence or across the national intelligence community for specific problem sets that are important to the president. Is that right? Sort of a defense intelligence officer?
At the DNI level, we have national intelligence managers for various things. That's certainly a pinnacle. Within the analytical career field at DI, I would say being a deputy J2, deputy intelligence officer at a combatant command, is probably one of those jobs, coin of the realm, really, really important job. You got to make sure that you have your act together with the target set that you're working on, but also have the personality to be able to interact with the J2 and the combatant commander. Sometimes that's not always easy, and sometimes you don't find that in the same individual. So you know, this ability to be aggressive, but also be someone who can listen really well and communicate really well is key. And for all of our analysts, if you can't write, if you can't brief, that's really kind of the going in position that you have to develop your trade craft on, so that you communicate whatever that message is and whatever people need to know. If you can't communicate, then it's really, really going to be tough. And so for the introverts that come in, I love them. I'll take introverts, but we're gonna make a bit of an extrovert out of you.
I know exactly how that works, because I am a very, very much an introverted person. General, thank you for covering how DIA fits into the Department of Defense and the broader U.S. intelligence community. If it's okay with you, I'd like to turn to what's happening in the world today, sort of tap into your expertise as a career intelligence officer in the United States Army. And I, if I could, I'd like to begin with the topic that you were just mentioning a little while that gets 24/7 coverage at DIA, and that's the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the situation in Ukraine. What can you share with our listeners about what the analysts at DIA think the Russians have planned for their ongoing campaign in Ukraine? Obviously, nothing classified, but what the interpretations are that that you feel you could talk about here publicly. Any insights you'd be willing to share with us?
Sure. Before I do that, though, I think I need to take you on a bit of a spin first. And so,
absolutely.
when I entered the Army in 1984, it was this bipolar world of the Soviet Union and the United States. My first assignment as an Army military intelligence officer was as a second lieutenant assigned to the 172nd Infantry Brigade in Alaska. Our mission was to defend the Alyeska pipeline. At the time, I thought that was kind of a ridiculous mission set because the thinking was that Soviet Spetsnaz troops would parachute in to destroy and damage that pipeline. That is kind of real today.
Yes, it is.
it's come full circle here, and it's really interesting to watch what's happened with China and Russia and how well-crafted our national defense strategy is on these problems. But even if you think about that, my 38-year career, after the wall came down, we were sort of in the army of the in-between. So 1990 to 2000, we trained a lot. So did the Navy, so did the Air Force. And we got really, really good at the war we weren't going to fight. And then 9/11 happens, and we go through the trauma of a 20-year counterterrorist fight where it's, hey, you train with the unit, you deploy with the unit, yeah, you come back and you start that cycle all again, and there's loss and there's commitment. That actually made our military, I think, very, very good. And so, as we have come around to this notion of strategic competition, I think we're ready for it. And as I think about what has happened in Russia, Ukraine, it's really kind of put us to the test. And if you think about the beginning of the conflict, DIA with our other IC partners came out very, very early and said this was going down, it was going to happen. And then our president made a very brave decision to say, okay, we need to tell the world about this. And so policies rapidly changed to be able to support that. And I remember those early days, policies were changing pretty quickly. And suddenly people were going, oh, okay, we get it. We now understand what you're talking about. So in terms of intelligence as a tool, as a weapon, very, very valuable in how we got our partners thinking about this. So first insight is rapid sharing, rapid policy development and change is a good thing. Probably better if you have it before you need it, but at its best before you need it, but also the ability to modify and change on the fly, really, really important, because that allowed us to do things with our NATO partners and also allowed us to do things with our Ukrainian partners. So very, very interesting. So we did great on that aspect of predicting what was going to go down, when it was going to go down. But I think some of our biases got in the way of how we analyzed what might come out of it. And so, if you think about the Russian army, the new look army, I remember the army did a study called the new gen Russian warfare model, where we studied how Putin had invested in his army. That army actually looked pretty good. I mean, they weren't 10 feet tall or anything, but it looked like he had made wise investments. All of his officers go to the Friends Academy. You know, from post-World War II on, they took what was Blitzkrieg doctrine and turned it into what we called airland battle doctrine. They understood the employment of intelligence, reconnaissance, surveillance, and fires. They knew how to do that with command and control. We lost the bubble on them after 9/11, and we probably weren't paying as much attention as we should. So our biases played in when we thought how this fight would go. And we probably didn't understand well enough the kind of grit that our Ukrainian partners really, really had. And so on one hand, did really, really well predicting when. Maybe we could have done better on predicting how it would come out. I think the interesting thing is the Russians really planned for an occupation, not an invasion. And so all of those things that maybe they understood about war fighting, they thought they were just going to roll in and topple the government and take over. Didn't go like that. And the Ukrainians had a very different plan. Now, we've been instrumental with Ukrainians in helping them, not only with material support, building the moral support that most of the world has in support of their cause, but also with the information sharing that we're doing with them through our European command partners and even back here at DI. So that is a huge success story. As the fight has played out, the Russians overcommitted without planning, and now they find themselves in a bit of a bind. And so they've lost some territory. The Ukrainians have gone on a counteroffensive. And I think, you know, the latest on this this partial mobilization really to me dictates what a bind Putin is in. He didn't go to a full mobilization. He's not called, or he's not changed the name of the special military operation. And at the same time, they're working these sham referendums. And so, you know, thinking about this, perhaps Putin is like thinking, okay, how do I best salvage this? And it might be call the referendum and then hunker down. We don't know. Certainly, we're watching it really, really carefully with Ukrainian progress and what the Russians are bringing in. We're not really sure how soon they'll be able to bring in this increase in manpower that they have, but we're really watching it carefully. And it doesn't bode well for the winter for either force when I look at it.
And you mentioned a little while ago that your first assignment was up there in the northern part of Alaska, protecting the oil pipeline. Just in the news a couple of days ago, we had something happen with the Nord Stream natural gas pipeline that goes from Russia to Germany and provides so much of the energy needed to heat homes all across Europe in the wintertime. Any thoughts on what happened with that? I won't ask you to reveal anything, but I can see you're laughing here as I'm asking this question, but it's a really interesting question. You know, what happened, and if somebody did do something, why did they do it, and who was it that did it?
That is a great question. I mean, I think about the irony of my statement about the Alyeska pipeline in Alaska and the Nord Stream pipeline that's pushing natural gas to Europe. I think too early to tell, early days in this analysis, but you know, there are theories out there, so we'll watch to see what plays out here and what comes out in the public on that.
And I know, General, because we're a DIA, you're focusing on really important strategic questions. Putin has sort of subtly, or maybe not so subtly, talked a little bit about nuclear weapons. How much of a concern, from your perspective, is this threat from Putin on the battle space in Ukraine?
I have a tendency to listen to him when he talks. He has a bunch of subordinate leaders in various positions that are talking about this. So I think we have to take it seriously. DIA has this as a priority to look at, to analyze, to understand escalation here in this conflict and what that means not only for the United States, but what also it means for our partners in NATO, but also Russia. So something we're very concerned about. To not be concerned, I think, would be a little foolhardy here. So I think we have to be concerned, talk about it, and gain the insights that we can on their intent. We understand what their doctrine is, but the way this conflict has played out, they really haven't followed their doctrine. And so that's what makes it kind of the wild card here. So we will be watching very, very carefully with our partners. And this is where our NATO partners can give us insight as well. They live there. They understand the Russians as well or better than we do. And so certainly understanding how they see it is going to be really important for us.
You know, your assessment, self-assessment of DIA and the broader intelligence community, taking a look at the Russian military, assuming that they would be more effective than they were when they first launched that invasion. I actually had Lieutenant General Ben Hodges on the show about 6 weeks into the invasion. For our listeners, he was the former commander of U.S. Army forces in Europe, and he was just fantastic in his discussion about all the ways in which we sort of, misinterpreted what Russian capabilities were really going to be. We thought with these, the investment that Putin and the Russian political leadership had made into modernizing their military, creating these battalion tactical groups, training at a smaller unit level, all of those things would be more effective than they turned out to be. The logistics supply lines was just horrible. The small unit leadership, even the senior leadership in the military operation, was terrible. Turned out that the quality of the equipment that had been produced inside Russia was terrible. All across the board, it was just bad. This partial call-up that Putin is ordering, you just mentioned it's hard to know how long it's going to take to get those 300,000 people or so that some have former military service, most don't probably, to get them trained up and into the fight. Does it make a difference that he's done this, considering the lack of equipment or quality equipment or poor supply lines? Have they solved these other problems? I mean, are we seeing any of this in the Ukraine fight right now?
Well, I think those are really key questions. You know, the number 300,000 is really debatable. And then his ability to equip that force is another question. So you know, the ability to have this, you know, to declare partial mobilization and put those forces into the field with kit is another matter altogether. Look, he's committed a large part of his ground army to this fight. Much of it has been destroyed by Ukrainian fires and good solid planning and operations on their part. So it remains to be seen how quickly he can do that. Certainly, there are stocks from the old Soviet days that are sitting around in boneyards. Certainly, some of that stuff could be made to be operational. How quickly they can move maintenance teams to that and get it repaired and move to Ukraine is another story altogether. But when I think about the biases in our view of the Russian army, you know, think about the training that we go through as a military. It doesn't matter what service you're in. In the Army, the Crucible is going to the National Training Center, the Joint Readiness Training Center, the Maneuver Training Center at Hohenfels. And that is a force-on-force free play that just comes out naturally. You either win or you lose. And if you lose, it's an AAR in an auditorium, and it's pointed out very harshly what commanders, what staff officers failed to learn and do. I think their training's probably really scripted. I think we thought that they were better because we train that way. We think all armies train that way, but it turns out they didn't. So they had the material, they had the leaders, but they didn't have the small unit leaders, and they didn't put it together. I think really their failure is a failure to plan, which you know, every plan fails on first contact. But if you don't start out with a plan, it's really going to go bad quickly.
Yeah. For our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Lieutenant General Scott Barrier. He's the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Lieutenant General Barrier, I'd like to turn to China, if I could. We have about 14 minutes left, plenty of time to talk about important topics. Some of our combat leaders and policymakers believe 2027 is a critical year for China to decide whether or not to attempt to seize Taiwan by force. How do you and the analysts at DIA see the China-Taiwan situation and what Chinese capabilities most concern you?
So, hey, great question, and sort of the topic of the hour, if not the week, if not the year. I have a tendency to listen to Xi Jinping when he speaks, and if he's talked about reunification of Taiwan and he's told his military to be ready by 2027, I take him at his word. And from what we have seen about their development in every warfighting domain, whether that's space, cyber, ground, air, maritime, they've expanded rapidly since 1990. There are some really interesting charts out there that show this rapid growth and how they can influence within the first island chain, how they can influence within the second island chain. And their capacity and capability is growing. And so I think this discussion about 2027 is really key for us. I think the issue is what lessons is the PLA learning from all of this with Russia and Ukraine?
Yep.
How the world has kind of coalesced around the Ukrainian cause, and what does that mean for an attempt by the PRC to take Taiwan? We don't know the answers to those questions yet, because I think the Chinese it takes them a while to assimilate these lessons and learn. We would hope that the lesson that they would take is probably not a good idea to do this by force. That the economic blows, that the military blows, no matter where they come from, would perhaps limit their ability and appetite to do this. And so it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Let's not kid ourselves though. They have grown some pretty significant military capability. You know, I think about what they've developed in space, what they can do in cyber, how their Navy has developed, what they're doing with their higher gen aircraft right now. They're getting ready for something. And if you look at their capabilities, I always think about the Chinese in this three-stranded cable, right? One cable is this political strategy that Xi has had in his time in tenure, where he's been able to do the things that he wants to do politically, put the people in place that he needs to continue to control. He's got this economic strategy, formerly known as the Belt Road Initiative, which has sort of spread his economy out. And it's grown their own economy in ways that are sometimes nefarious, sometimes not great for host countries. And then he's had this military strategy, which has created this larger military force that he has that is becoming more capable all the time. But when I think about that cable is wrapped in the sheath, and that sheath is the what I have said is the greatest intellectual theft of property in the history of mankind. And so if you think about it. Whole of government approach to espionage and stealing of secrets. And that is not a secret. I think that's a pretty well-known fact. And so we've got to get smart about protecting our networks, doing things better, faster, and safer in cyber, not only with the Department of Defense, but also also with our defense industrial base and protecting the information that we have.
So the Chinese Communist Party is about to have their next party Congress, I guess, here in mid-October. And Xi Jinping is looking at probably, almost assuredly at this point, getting appointed for an unprecedented third five-year term as president. What do you make of that? I mean, he's going to cement his control over all of these things that you've just been talking about. Does that make things more likely to go badly for the China-Taiwan situation? Is the U.S. heading for conflict with China? Or is there still a way to avoid that through diplomacy, from your perspective?
I always think that diplomacy and talking are better than fighting. But listen, you know, the party Congress is going to happen. I think the thing that's different that he probably didn't count on was how this Russia-Ukraine thing panned out. And so I think he's got to be very, very careful about how he messages to the party. What is this relationship with Russia right now, and where does it go in the future? And so if you think about it, there have been a lot of statements in the recent past about how close that relationship is. My sensing is that there's a little bit of frustration on the PRC side about how the fight's going and wishing that it would kind of be over. And really, when you just the fact that we're having this conversation about how this could affect 2027 in Taiwan is a conversation that Xi Jinping would rather us not have.
That's right.
I think it's going to be a little different. And it's going to come out a little differently than what she wanted it. So we'll wait for the results of that conference. It's going to be interesting. You know, if you've seen politically lately, President Putin is taking it on the chin a little bit with some criticism there. So he's got a little domestic problem at home, especially with the military recall here, and we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, and this is another thing that General Hodges and I talked about. It's one thing to launch an invasion across a land border. It's another thing entirely to carry out what would have to be an amphibious assault across 100 miles of open ocean between the mainland China and onto Taiwan. You could have airborne assaults, and you could have certainly missile strikes and airstrikes that support you, and naval actions that support that. But that is a highly complex military operation to carry out. Any thoughts on that?
Well, extremely complicated and extremely high risk.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there aren't that many places where the PLA and the Navy can actually enforce a lodgment there. And so I think the people of Taiwan have to take a look at this and say, okay, what lessons can we learn here, and how hard can we make this, and how can we convince Xi Jinping that he shouldn't do this? I think there are some things that they could do, and I think we're in those kinds of discussions with Taiwan right now. But I do find it very interesting, very high risk. You know, if anything, World War II taught us that these operations are really, really costly. And that hasn't changed. I mean, the technology has changed, but the principle of putting men and women on boats to do a lodgment in an airborne or air assaults onto the mainland, it would be really dangerous. And I'm not sure that they could withstand the kind of losses. And we know that they haven't fought a war in a long time. And so it was 1979, it didn't go as well as they wanted it to with Vietnam. And, you know, speaking of Vietnam and other partners, I think there is an appetite to have discussions with partners in the Pacific. And, you know, if you recall, Barack Obama, our president, then said, hey, we got to pivot to the Pacific. DIA has been on a journey to do that. And so as we look at our own readiness as an agency and where we need to be, we think our posture in the Pacific could improve. I've had these discussions with Indo-PACOM. And so we're making some moves now to increase our posture there. And we think over the next year or two, we're going to be in a bit of a better position here. But listen, this is going to go on. You know, the question of 2027 will remain. I'm sorry, I can't give you a straight answer on that.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
depending on who you talk to, it's 25 or 26 or maybe 28, 29, or maybe even later than that. You know, our goal would be to so effectively compete in this strategic competition space that that China says, you know what, we just don't want to do this militarily. We're going to try some other way.
Yeah, deterrence is always best, right? If to avoid war, always be prepared for war.
Absolutely. That's so, you know, we're supporting the Department of Defense on this. We just want to bring insights to our secretary and our chairman and our combatant commanders to give them the decision space they need to make plans and do what they can do.
Yeah. General, we only have about 5 minutes left or so in the show. I think at this point, our listeners no doubt have a much greater appreciation for DIA's national security mission, all that you do to support our policymakers on the civilian side, certainly the leadership within the Department of Defense, and all the combatant commanders around the world, as well as supporting our partners. For those inspired to apply for positions at DIA, what kind of qualifications specifically are you seeking for candidates, and what kind of career paths could young people have if they were hired on at DIA?
So I appreciate that question because the sky is the limit. About every week or so, I have the opportunity to swear in the latest class of DIA officers who are just rolling in for the first time. And it's really cool to do that because a lot of these folks don't have military experience and it's the first time they're actually taking the oath. So I link that oath and the commitment to our Constitution to the blue security badge that everybody gets. And that's a deal and you can't break that deal. So we're going to give you the keys to the kingdom on a top secret network. You have to be able to perform and you're taking the oath. So you're now part of this national security enterprise. But whether you come in to be an analyst, a counterintelligence agency, a DIA cop, whether you're a logistics person, whether you're an accountant, a program manager, or whether you're a human intelligence collector or a scientist, the sky is the limit in DIA in terms of what you can do. And so we just want people who are motivated, intellectually curious, who want to serve their country and want to be part of this national security enterprise.
General, if our listeners wanted to read unclassified reporting from DIA directly, is there a mechanism for them to do so, to stay informed?
There is. One of the things that made us famous in the 1970s and 80s where we did these unclassified military power studies to expose what the Soviet Union was doing. And we couldn't use real imagery because it was classified, so we used artist renderings. And they were pretty cool. We handed them out to all of our friends and partners around the world. You can actually access those on a DIA.mil website right now. We have an unclassified pub on China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and space counterspace. Really, really good reads. You can put them on your desk and print them out. And they're available, and we'll continue to upgrade those and probably produce more in the coming months and years.
General, I always like to give my guests sort of the last word. Is there anything you'd like to say about the people who work at the Defense Intelligence Agency?
Listen, I'm so thankful you're giving me this opportunity. I am inspired every single day as I move around DIA, as I go to our different facilities, as I engage officers who have been here 2 months, or I engage the officers that have been here 30 or 35 years. What they do and how committed they are to our national security and our country is amazing. And it's the honor of my life, probably in the last assignment I'm going to have to lead this organization. We've got a great team. They're doing the work every single day. And I want the American people to know that they can trust their Defense Intelligence Agency to do the right thing when we need to. So, John, thanks very much.
You bet, sure. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of today's edition of National Security This Week. Lieutenant General Scott Barrier, Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, thank you so much for the opportunity to learn from you today about all the things that DIA does and where they fit into the defense intelligence enterprise and more broadly the U.S. intelligence community.
John, thanks very much. And personally, thank you for your service, not only to the Navy, but also this defense intelligence enterprise. And I know you've been inside DIA headquarters a time or two, and you know what we're about. So it's really good to see you, and thanks for your service.
Two tours inside DIA. One as naval attaché and one as in a capacity I'm not going to talk about. Folks, that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. Look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for being a listener to National Security This Week. Have a great finish to your week. Take care, everyone.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.